Hello, fellow Earth folks. I'm Annie Gigg, GYG, here on CFRU 93.3 FM and CFRU.ca, available wherever you are in the world. Warm welcome to Better Me, Better World, the show for growth-minded change-makers, difference-makers, and happiness-makers. If you tuned in to the previous episode, you'll recall that I've begun telling my life story with the hopes that it will inspire you to tell your story in whatever way works best for you. I ended the episode saying, my story is neither more nor less important than your story, but it's unique, as is your story, and it's that uniqueness that makes each person's story extremely valuable. You have precious nuggets to share that no one else on this planet can offer, even if you don't see the nuggets, or even if you see them but think them fool's gold. They're not. They're valuable experiences embedded in your life, which you may not know are there until you sift them through the sieve of storytelling. Once they become apparent to you in your telling, your life quality is enhanced through greater self-awareness and self-understanding. And in the telling of your story, without question, someone, or perhaps many someones out there, will also greatly benefit from hearing how you made it through, or how you found courage, or how you learned from your mistake, or how you recovered, or how you're still fighting, or how you achieved it, or how you didn't give up, or how you climbed up from rock bottom, or how you empowered your greater self. How. Said Morgan Harper Nichols, tell the story of the mountain you climbed. Your words could be a page in someone else's survival guide. Most, if not all, of us humans, regardless of our life station, at some point in time feel like we are struggling to survive, mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually, socially, economically. If your story could provide content for the survival guide of another person climbing the same or similar mountain that you've climbed or are still climbing, how great of a contribution would that be to making that person's world and the world as a whole a better place? I'm going to change metaphors here from mountains to water to illustrate in another way the great value of your storytelling. Actually, more like the great waste if you do not tell your story. The water metaphor issues from an account I heard several years ago while idly chatting with a fellow attendee between presentations at a conference in connection with my then work in municipal government. This person lived in northern Ontario, Canada, and near to his house was a spring of crystal clear, delicious, fresh water that flowed continuously at an exceptional rate. The spring water wasn't tapped or used for any purpose. It simply flowed into a ditch and eventually made its way into whatever body of water it was destined for. That shocked me. I thought, what a waste! Not in the sense of it not being commercialized for business profit, but in the sense that so many people in the world are literally dying for lack of potable water, and here is an abundance of pure spring water flowing away every minute of every day. The matter obviously didn't impact the person telling me about it as much as it affected me. There's no lack of easily accessible clean drinking water in his neck of the woods. Now, I see this indelible image of wasted water as akin to the waste of a person's untold life story. If that water could be tapped into by people dying of thirst, oh, how it would change or even save their lives. If people thirsting for guidance through life could tap into your relatable experiences through your storytelling, how might their lives change? Have you ever heard or read someone else's story and been thunderstruck because that was exactly what you needed to hear in that moment? Well, that's what your story will do for someone else. You might never know it, but it will. Oh, and one other very good reason to tell your story, as per Maya Angelou, there is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you. And so I continue with chapter 2 of my story, Miss Cellophane. Definition of cellophane, a thin, transparent wrapping material made from viscose, as in a cellophane bag. I've shared lyrics elsewhere in Better Me, Better World episodes taken from the song written by John C. Reilly called Mr. Cellophane and sung in the musical stage play and movie Chicago. When I first heard them, I cried from way down inside because the words deeply penetrated a long-time festering wound. Here's part of the song. Everyone gets noticed now and then, unless, of course, that personage should be invisible, inconsequential me. Cellophane. Mr. Cellophane should have been my name. Mr. Cellophane, 'cause you can look right through me, walk right by me, and never know I'm there. Can you believe it? Having traveled so far along my BU journey since first hearing those lyrics, they still bring tears to my eyes, damn it. But that's the way it is with deep old wounds from way back in childhood. We never do heal from them completely, because no matter how well we've recovered, the tender scar will always remain. But thankfully, with awareness and understanding, we gain the power to quickly expose the pain to the light and extinguish its ability to cause us any more than a tiny prick of suffering that reminds us of how far we've come. I don't think at any time during my childhood I could have articulated that I felt painfully invisible, though I surely must have felt the pain because I sought out ways to counteract it. And I distinctly remember moments when I suddenly wasn't invisible, when somebody saw me, just me, not me as a part of a collective of kids. I suppose being fourth of nine children was enough in itself to make me susceptible to invisibility, but it had to be more than just my birth order in the family that contributed to it, because I don't recall any of my other middle birth order siblings ever sharing about the same pains I've expressed. Or perhaps they haven't necessarily examined themselves the way I have. I think with everything, however, how it manifests in our life is a combination of both nature and nurture. And although my siblings and I share many commonalities of nurturing, no one else shares my nature. So the uniquely formed me, being a mishmash of my nature and nurture, is today talking about invisibility. I said I remember moments when someone saw me, specifically Mom saw me. The first instance was definitely preschool. I was sitting on the kitchen floor, writing my name with a pencil on paper, and Mom noticed my attempts. I've never forgotten this noticing when she told me that the vertical lines on my N's shouldn't be so long because it made them look more like H's. I happily truncated the lines and cherished that moment. Maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 years later, a similar situation occurred, which again I locked away in my happy memories box. This time I was drawing a princess in a beautiful dress in profile. I'd rendered the princess with a swelling of the bosom that then appropriately curved back in and down towards a slender waist. However, on top of the bosom, which I guess I must have been thinking as just the princess's chest wall, I drew in a round globe. Perhaps in passing, Mom glanced down at my artwork, or perhaps I showed it to her, but whatever. She told me the round globe was redundant, not that she used that word. She explained that the swelling bosom line I'd drawn was sufficient in itself. In both these instances, I was being corrected, which, as I'll speak of in a future episode, I had difficulty with. And the correction aspect may be part of the reason these two occasions have remained indelible in my memory, but I'm quite certain it was more because Mom was devoting her precious time, and it was a scarce commodity for her, to helping me, just me, learn. Oh, Mom was as good as a mom could ever be at helping all of us with our homework and reading to us collectively before we could read on our own and listening to our prayers as preschoolers. But those personal, just me and Mom, spontaneous, interactive instances were memorable. One instance with Mom that should have been interactive but never came to be involved my attempt to get her attention when she was sitting in the backyard, enjoying wine in the summer sunshine with my aunts and uncles. I had to tell her something really, really important. I want to give a warning here. What I'm about to briefly mention concerns sexual behavior involving my 7 or 8 year old self, So if hearing that may be triggering or otherwise unacceptably disturbing to you, you may want to mute the broadcast for about 10 or 15 seconds now. I had been taken to the shed by a cousin, about 5 years my senior, and inappropriately touched in what I knew as private places, while he had me sit on his lap. I'll be delving more deeply into the impacts of this event in a later episode. After I screwed up the courage to get away, I needed to so badly tell my mom what happened. But whether I was unable to articulate what that was due to associated shame, or mom wasn't in a space to grasp what I was trying to say, I don't know. And my important story never got heard, at least not for another half century or so. Invisible, inconsequential me. At school, there were ways I attempted to combat my perceived invisibility and inconsequentialness, and these ways may have helped me get attention I was seeking, but undoubtedly also contributed to my sense of unlikableness, which was another yoke around my neck until I saw it for what it was. One recollection is from grade one. I know it was grade one because of who the teacher was, and that we students were still in the old brick schoolhouse when it housed grades 1 to 8 in one of its two rooms, with the other room used as the gym, in quotation marks. Grade one was the first year of my school experience, as kindergarten had not yet been introduced to our small rural school. I quickly became a tattletale teller, informing Mrs. Clare of what I construed to be reportable events happening in the schoolyard. I enjoyed the one-on-one interaction with the teacher, feeling I had something important to offer her, that I was consequential, until she, in no uncertain terms, asked me to stop being a tattletale. This comeuppance likely contributed to this memory-making, but until then, I fondly recall the sensation of being heard and seen by the teacher outside of normal class activities by assuming that schoolyard reporter responsibility. Another way of gaining attention I learned while still in that same classroom was via public speaking. I don't have a clue why I was in front of grades 1 to 8 talking about a cow who was unknowingly pregnant and couldn't figure out why she was getting fatter and fatter. It was a rather risque topic back in the day, but wow, did I gobble up the laughter and applause my talk generated. The next year, in grade 2, I won the public school speaking contest with my talk about our family's visit to recently opened Disneyland in Anaheim, California. With this win, I proceeded to the next level of competition between area elementary schools. Once again, I basked in the attention I was given, especially for being such a young competitor up against other speakers from the higher grades. I recall the judges joking how my feet didn't even touch the floor as I sat on my chair waiting my turn to speak. I quickly became that freaky kid who actually enjoyed public speaking. I feigned terror about getting on stage in attempt to fit in with my classmates, but in reality, I was happily excited, anticipating my moment in the spotlight, aiming for visibility while people saw me and recognition by award winning. Many, many years later, I would come to understand how my focus on filling my need to be noticed and awarded detracted from my effectiveness as a speaker. As an adult, I fell short over and over again, racking up disappointment after disappointment in my speaking gigs because of the why of my speaking: to get attention and applause, to satisfy a need to be visible and consequential. I thought all along it was about skill, but as I more clearly see it now, it was primarily my attempt to satisfy a need. It wasn't until I developed sufficient self-awareness and self-understanding that I came to recognize how I was self-sabotaging. Until I addressed my neediness, it would continue to compromise my ability to develop any latent speaking skill I may have. Thankfully, that discovery sent me down the path of self-development and self-love. My personal growth journey over more than 3 decades brought me to a place of being enabled to focus my attention on the expectations and requirements of the audience instead of my own unaddressed needs. That's when I could truly begin to feel the rewards of speaker-audience connection. And my journey continues. But back to where I was in elementary school all those years ago. Being a tattletale and award-winning public speaker still wasn't enough to quench my thirst for visibility. Totally unbeknownst to me at the time, there was a hole in my bucket, and any dribbles of attention I could collect in my bucket would only drip out the hole. So I became a high achiever. The fact that I was in the middle of a family of 9 siblings was out of my control, but my academic standing wasn't. I learned early on that I caught Mom and Dad's attention and praise when I excelled at something. They noticed me. I became academically competitive, not content to be in the middle of the pack. I strove for the alpha position, needing the A's to validate me, make me seeable at home and at school. But that recognition was a double-edged sword at school. I quickly learned, brown noser, teacher's pet, bootlicker. In my early school years, it was the practice for each student to receive a report card that not only indicated our own marks in all the subjects, but also the marks achieved by all our fellow classmates in the same grade, without their names included. Being in such a small school, however, with as few as 3 or 4 kids in some grades, it was very easy to put names to the unidentified marks in the report card. Perhaps the thinking at the time was that comparing your own academic achievements with your fellow classmates would be a motivator, as if you're in a race and seeing how you're positioned relative to the other runners can get you running faster. Whatever the wisdom of the day, it fed into my insatiable thirst for standing out. Yes, I was obsessed with standing out somehow, some way. From childhood well into adulthood, I continuously compared myself to my 3 older sisters and continuously found myself lacking. What did I see? Louise being so well-read and always up on current affairs. Marine being so pretty and beautifully dressed. Denise, well, she just about masters anything she puts her mind to, particularly back in the day, piano playing, and still into today, oil painting. I was none of those things. I was not a master of anything. There was no reason for anyone to see me. Academia was my best bet, and there I did do well, but dang it all along my bucket had a hole in it. No matter the high standings, the awards, the scholarships, it was never enough for me to satiate my visibility and appreciation thirst. I had good friends throughout my school years who I know did appreciate me, but characteristically, as I've spoken of in depth elsewhere, I felt like a fringe dweller in any social group. I was part of it, yes, but not at the core. My sense of being on the periphery initially developed in elementary school and deepened into high school and beyond. I considered a certain house rule to be a major contributor to the exclusion, I felt. The rule was no television watching after supper on school nights. So when my friends were laughing and talking over each other at lunch about the Carol Burnett Show, or it might have been the Love Boat, or All in the Family the evening before, I just quietly smiled. Another contributor, I determined, was music, or more accurately, the lack of it in our home. Mom had a record player in the living room and a fair number of records, primarily the scores of musicals she liked, such as The King and I or Oklahoma, although I recall them being played only occasionally. One of Mom's records was of instrumental music and included Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon and Garfunkel, which my 15-year-old self would play over and over again, listening with my eyes closed as I lay on the couch in the dark, singing the missing words to myself. When you're weary, feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I'll dry them all. La 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 la, like a bridge over troubled water, I'll lay me down. Would he lay himself down for invisible me? The radio in the kitchen was turned on in the mornings for the news, but not tuned in to a favorite music station at any point during the day. None of us kids had records. None of us had our own radios. I don't think it would have been denied if we'd ever wanted to bring music into the house, but we never wanted to. The Beatles and their ilk were poo-pooed by my parents. By high school, normal kids had their favorite musicians and were crazy about such and such song that just came out. Again, I sat there invisibly when my friends argued for Let's Get It On by Marvin Gaye, or Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree by Tony Orlando and Dawn, or You're So Vain by Carly Simon, or Bad Bad Leroy Brown by Jim Croce. I pretended to sing along to lyrics while music blared from the car radio on Saturday nights as the group of us friends toured about the township. In hindsight, I can clearly see how my inability to join in on chatter about TV shows and pop music did exacerbate my lonely sense of invisibility, but it certainly wasn't the cause of it. That understanding would come much later. And ironically, when I was eventually able to repair the hole in my bucket with self-love, I no longer needed to try to catch dribbles of visibility and consequentialness. My excessive need as a kid, a teenager, a young adult was certainly one of those things that, until examined, was quite self-sabotaging. Needing attention, appreciation, validation, I now know, is a normal, healthy part of growing up. But being so needy that it bends you out of shape into thinking you have value only in doing, achieving, and exceeding, instead of having value simply in being, conversely undermines your sense of self-worth. It becomes a self-perpetuating sense of worthlessness through something called confirmation bias. This means, already feeling invisible, anything that happened I'd construe to be further evidence of my invisibility. When aunts or uncles chatted with one or more of my older sisters and not me, that was evidence I was invisible, worthless, and unlikable. In more recent years, I could see how they got to know my older sisters more intimately as children than me or my younger siblings. Due to the exponential growth of our extended family of nieces and nephews, which made the adults closely connecting with all the youngsters become increasingly more difficult. Today, I have numerous nieces, nephews, and grandnieces and nephews. It seems so ludicrous to me now that any one of them would disparage themselves because I missed engaging with them. But for me, back in the day, that non-engagement by an adult was a sure sign of my nothingness. When a teacher or presenter or a friend in a group didn't make eye contact with me when they were speaking, that was evidence of my invisibility, worthlessness. I recall staring fixedly at them as if that could somehow force eye contact and reassure me I was seeable, worth their glance. At other times, I was grateful I was unseeable. In my teen years, my mom and dad had no idea what I was up to, drinking alcohol illegally, smoking pot, arriving home in the wee hours of the morning, too tipsy to brush my teeth. As a teen, I certainly relished the freedom of invisibility, but I wonder if on another level it confirmed yet again, I'm not worth their glance. How could my parents have devoted attention to a 15-year-old with a household of 9 children ranging in age from 2 to 21? Mind you, my oldest sister was married and moved out by then, especially with 2 rebellious sons a tad younger than me. It's known in the field of psychology that if your parents paid little attention to you throughout childhood and into your teen years, it can manifest as a sense of insignificance and rejection well into adulthood. As I said earlier, this understanding has no blame or resentment towards my parents attached to it. I firmly believe, like all of us, they were doing the best they could with the wisdom and life experience they had. And I don't pass judgment on myself either. Not anymore, for seeking the remedies, albeit the further exacerbating remedies, I did seek to try to cope with being Miss Cellophane, to being unseen. Ironically, part of my coping was to leave home at age 17 with a girlfriend to attend university in a small city a couple of hours away. I longed for the anonymity that I could claim moving away from my small, faith-based rural community where I felt everyone knew everything about everyone. What? Really? Doesn't that totally contradict my sense of invisibility if I felt everyone knew everything about me? No, because it wasn't the real me they thought they knew, and I would add in my mind with confirmation bias and didn't like. I had no idea who the real me was, but intuitively I was running towards her and away from the me who felt like I had to hide my authentic self. It's one thing for others to not like or accept the masked version of yourself that you allow them to see, because their rejection of that pseudo-you doesn't say anything about the real you. But I felt at the time, if I was to allow people to see the real me and that version was rejected, I'd have nothing left. And we have no more time left today for any more storytelling. I invite you to tune in to the next episode of Better Me, Better World as I elaborate on some matters I alluded to in this episode. I'll be back same time next week, same place here at CFRU 93.3 FM or CFRU.ca. The shows are recorded, so alternatively, have a listen when it works best for you. Until next time, be you. I'm Annie Gigg.